Right, I'm running a bit late. Good morning. Are you well? Running just a tad late, been editing right up till the deadline there and ran over and then realised, well, Richie, there's no harm in being a couple of minutes late. No harm at all. Hope you're well. It's a wet and windy, miserable old Manchester morning here in South Manchester as it approaches 2.5 minutes past the hour for Sunday, January 13th, 2019. I am Richie Allen. How you doing, by the way? Hope you've had a good weekend. Looking forward to your company this morning for Sunday View. Got the Sunday broadsheet and tabloid newspapers here. We'll be looking at the front pages of those momentarily. As usual, you can join in with me by simply tweeting the programme. My Twitter handle is at Richie Allen Show. It hasn't changed. Yeah, that wasn't meant to happen. It hasn't changed for, well, since forever. So let's do it. Welcome to the programme, then. Good to be with you this Sunday.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show.
Might push this programme back to 12 noon next week. With the advent of the Mara Show starting a bit later, it might be handy. We'll see. I'll let you know in due course anyway. Welcome to Sunday View. Thanks for joining me.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yeah, we got there in the end. So there's a lot to talk about then. If you are somebody who reads the Sunday newspapers yourself, you'll be aware that with the week that's in it and the week ahead, they are dominated by Brexit. And I'm obviously going to kick off the programme talking about Brexit, but I'll make it a bit more palatable, I think, today than the mainstream media makes it anyway. I'll make it a bit more exciting, maybe, without leaning towards exaggeration or hyperbole. I think we can still make it somewhat more exciting. But lots to talk about as well. Dr. David Kelly, of course, former weapons inspector. Yes, Dr. David Kelly, and the strangest suicide in history, has made the Mail on Sunday today. We'll talk about that a bit later on as well. And more. As much as we can fit in the time anyway. So good morning. And I want to kick off by saying huge good morning to Ian McKee, who tweeted me. I just saw it in the last couple of minutes there. Ian, good morning. He says, Richie, if you get the chance, give us a shout. Give a shout out to the Anti-Geoengineering Scotland group. We're having our first meeting at Strathclyde Park today at 12. This will be a monthly meet-up, different locations to make the public aware. Now, Ian, I know there's only so much you can do in a Twitter message with 240 characters, but give us a bit more information so that we can get news to our Scottish listeners who might want to take part in future meetings. So, meeting in Strathclyde Park today at midday. That's Anti-Geoengineering Scotland Group, Ian McKee. Good stuff. That's positive. That's taking action. That's doing something to raise awareness. And you've got to be in support of that. Hey. All right. Let's jump into the papers then. Brexit betrayal dominating. Remember, before Christmas, the UK Prime Minister Theresa May reached a deal with the European Union, this withdrawal agreement, and on Tuesday it goes to a vote in Westminster. It's widely expected to be voted down. It might be the end of Theresa May, we'll see, doesn't matter. Expendable, disposable, these people, they're not in charge. Puppets on a stage, it doesn't matter one way or the other. We'll see what happens anyway on Tuesday. So let's kick off with Rupert Murdoch's The Sunday Times. The headline on The Sunday Times front page is a very British coup. Downing Street has allegedly uncovered a plot by senior MPs who want to take control of the Brexit negotiations and basically move Theresa May to the substitutes bench. Now, according to The Sunday Times, they're saying a cross-party group of senior backbenchers is planning a very British coup if May loses this vote on Tuesday on her deal, as is expected. And The Sunday Times writes Theresa May has been warned that her government will lose its ability to govern after Downing Street uncovered a bombshell plot by senior MPs to seize control of Brexit negotiations. Cross-party group of backbenchers, including former Tory ministers, plan what one senior figure branded a very British coup. At least two groups of rebel MPs are plotting to change Commons rules. This is very important, this. At least two groups of rebel MPs plotting to change Commons rules so motions proposed by backbenchers take precedence over government business, upending the centuries-old relationship between executive and legislature. Do you get that? Very interesting, this. It's the talk of the town today. I've not been out in town. I just imagine it is the talk of the town. It's certainly the talk of the morning television and radio political shows. Two groups of rebel MPs change Commons rules. Motions proposed by backbenchers would take precedence over government business, which would basically turn things upside down and change the centuries-old relationship between executive and legislature. Is this happening? Well, Downing Street believes it is, and it would let MPs run riot and free to suspend Article 50, ultimately putting Brexit on hold, and this could even lead to the referendum result being overturned, something which the Sunday Times says would plunge the country into a constitutional crisis. How interesting. Vince Cable is the leader of the Liberal Democrats. Doesn't amount to a hill of beans these days. You could get more. You could fit the Lib Dems into a telephone box. But anyway, he is the leader of the Lib Dems. He is a rampant Remainer. And he was on the Andrew Marr show this morning. Andrew Marr asks him directly, are these rebel MPs working with the Speaker, John Bercow, to thwart the result of the referendum and change centuries-old regulations and centuries-old practice in the House of Commons? You'll hear Marr's question and Vince Cable's response.
Joined by Sir Vince Cable, leader of the Liberal Democrats. Welcome, Sir Vince. Can I ask, first of all, is it, so far as you're concerned, true that rebel Tory MPs and others are working with the Speaker to take back control of the agenda of the House of Commons from the executive?
Well, it's not a conspiracy, but it is clearly happening, and we saw that demonstrated last week. And it's very clear that opinion in Parliament is crystallising. There is no support for the government's deal. There is absolutely no support for no deal. And then that leaves us with a more limited range of options.
Well, let me come on to those. But on the no deal question, it's always been the case that although Parliament's against no deal, and that's clearly the case, Parliament's not able to do very much about it, or wasn't in the past, because no deal is in legislation, it's part of the law, and therefore you need to pass another law to stop it happening. And ordinary MPs can't initiate legislation. Is that what's now changing?
That is correct, but it is also very clear that no deal isn't something we just fall into. It is a choice of government. They can bring forward legislation to stop Article 50. Sir John Major was advocating that this morning, and it's clearly what should happen.
But if they don't, do you think backbenchers and opposition parties can now do that?
Yes, that's exactly what will happen, and that's exactly what we should be doing, because it would be absolutely outrageous and unforgivable if the chaotic circumstances of a no deal were allowed to happen. The government itself has demonstrated the folly and the dangers of going down this road, and it can't just allow it to happen by accident.
So Cable says, yeah, it's happening. The constitutional crisis that the Times labelled it this morning is actually happening, says Cable. And that's why it's so important that, especially on Sunday View, especially the first quarter of Sunday View, first third of Sunday View, that we talk about this, because it's important for future reference that people see and understand what is being done to them in plain sight. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it, to see it happening and to watch people's reaction to it. Has there been a reaction to it yet? I wouldn't have thought so. Will there be a reaction to it when Brexit is blocked and we end up staying in the European Union? I wouldn't have thought there'll be much of a reaction at all, really. There'll be some UKIP and Tommy Robinson supporters Not many of them, but they'll be out and they'll be shouting and bawling and screaming, and the media will love that because they will say, well, look, it was only a bunch of racists who wanted to leave the European Union anyway, so now it's for the best that we don't leave. I think the vast majority of people will just, very depressed, just go back to the mundane lives that they lead, that we all lead, I suppose. That's what's going to happen, right? So it's important that we talk about it. So that was Vince Cable. Now, the same question asked to Vince Cable by Andrew Marr was asked to Tory MP Anne-Marie Trevelyan. She is a staunch leaver. She wants to leave. And she was asked the same question about these MPs plotting with the Speaker to change how business is conducted in the House of Commons in order to prevent Brexit. So here's Sophie Ridge speaking with Anne-Marie Trevelyan. Interesting stuff.
If you look at the papers today, there's lots of stories in the Sunday Times, for example, mm-hmm. amongst others, about MPs who are absolutely opposed to the idea of a no-deal Brexit, talking about bringing new legislation to stop it happening.
Well, you know, that is a great challenge. And some of the, you know, the activity we've seen this week in Parliament with, you know, trying to so dramatically change how Parliament works that everything becomes completely unstable is indeed, as the Prime Minister said herself, you know, into unprecedented and uncharted territory. But that must not stop us from remembering that we gave the people a referendum. Now, it's a fairly blunt tool. Don't think any of us would disagree with that. But having done so, if we don't respect the result that they sent back to us, which is an order, it's not a nice idea for us to now continue to discuss. It was a very clear order.
Yeah, it was an order. It wasn't advice. It wasn't the government saying to people, what do you think about leaving the European Union? It was an order. It was said that it would be a generational thing and that it would be implemented, whatever happened. People voted to leave, and not only are we not leaving, but as I said a couple of seconds ago, at the risk of repeating myself, there's no hiding the mendacity. There's no hiding the corruption. It's in people's faces. Anyway, right, it was an order. Centuries of operating procedures in the House of Commons being changed. Constitutional meltdown. John Bercow, the Speaker, just doing what he likes. But don't direct your wrath at John Bercow. He's just a puppet. These people are puppets. They don't work for you. They never have done. They never will do. So the Sunday Telegraph then. Tories on the brink of imploding over Brexit. Self-explanatory. There's an historic split on the way, according to the Sunday Telegraph. The paper says a growing number of cabinet ministers believe they must move towards a softer Brexit to attract Labour's support. But Brexiteers warn this risks dividing the party. So Remainers on the Conservative benches at Westminster are saying Labour is a big problem for us because Labour seem to have the pulse of the people. People seem to want a softer Brexit. Labour seem to be offering that, even though Corbyn isn't saying anything. Well, you know, you get a different story from Corbyn. We'll hear from Corbyn shortly. But the Tories believe this, and they're saying we need to move towards a softer Brexit. And because of that, the Sunday Telegraph is suggesting that the Conservative Party could be fractured. It basically could split, and you could have another party maybe in the wake of that split. I don't know about that. The Mail on Sunday, little bit of intrigue, footsteps in the night, secret deals. The headline, Bercow's secret kill Brexit plot with Tory saboteur. This is about what happened last week when Dominic Grieve was allowed to add an amendment to Tuesday's vote. You know, there will be a vote in Westminster, I've already said this, on Tuesday, where MPs will vote on the deal that May agreed with the European Union. Last week, Dominic Grieve, it is fairly incredible, really. He tabled an amendment to that. His amendment said that if May loses on Tuesday, she must report back within 3 sitting days with a plan B. Now, going against centuries of tradition, Bercow said, OK, you can stick that amendment on. So there was a vote on Grieve's amendment, and he won, meaning that May must now come back to the House by Friday. Yeah, it would be Friday, if, as expected, she loses on Tuesday. So the Daily Mail is saying today, the Sunday Mail is saying that John Bercow met with Dominic Grieve hours before a learning... Excuse me, Richie. Grieve met with Bercow hours before allowing the former Attorney General to add this amendment. So they're... The Mail is hinting, the Mail on Sunday is hinting at a conspiracy here, a grand conspiracy. Footsteps in the night, secret meetings between Grieve and Bercow. He went to see Bercow, according to the Mail on Sunday. They hatched their plot there. They went back into the chamber and Bercow allowed Grieve to table his amendment. That's in the Mail on Sunday. In the Sunday Express, the headline on the front page is May, back my deal or face catastrophe. She's written in the Sunday Express today, has Theresa May. She's pleaded with MPs to back her Brexit deal. Not doing so, says Theresa May, risks the UK leaving with no deal or Brexit not happening at all. May said the Commons vote on her Brexit withdrawal deal would be the biggest and most important decision that any MP of her generation will be asked to make. She says, she writes, when you turned out to vote in the referendum, you did so because you wanted your voice to be heard. Some of you put your trust in the political process for the first time in decades. We cannot and must not let you down. Doing so would be a catastrophic and unforgivable breach of trust in our democracy. May in the Sunday Express today. Transport Secretary Chris Grayling was on Sophie Ridge on Sunday, which is a Sky News programme. Sophie Ridge asked him, is there a plan B if May loses the vote on Tuesday and has to come back very quickly with an alternative because of Dominic Grieve's amendment? Is there a plan B? This is Chris Grayling, Transport Secretary.
Well, let's cross that bridge when and if it happens. Right now, her focus, my focus, the government's focus is on convincing people that actually this is the best thing to do. It's the right option. It's the most likely to deliver Brexit. And we want to convince colleagues that it's the right thing to do to back it.
I understand that, you know, you want to focus on the vote ahead, but people are quite worried. I mean, I spent the week in Harlow, for example, where people are really concerned about what happens next if the deal falters. So let's make a deal. Don't have to tell me what plan B is, but you have got one, right?
Well, look, the important thing right now is to convince people otherwise. I mean, I'm not going to get into, will we do this, will we do that, will we do the other? The important thing is to say to fellow MPs, those concerns are out there, and there's big concerns. Are we going to leave? Are we going to deliver Brexit? Are we going to somehow try and reverse Brexit? Is Parliament going to force us to reverse Brexit? What we have is, I think, a sensible compromise deal. It's not giving everybody everything they want. But it was never going to. This was a 52-48 result.
Yeah. 52-48 result. Therefore, we have to take into consideration what the 48% might want as well. A recurring theme, this, of course. And yeah, that was Chris Grayling there. Grayling knows it's over, of course. They're not going anywhere. He knows it. Sunday Observer. Labour set to trigger vote to topple May government. This isn't news. It's the front page of The Observer, but it isn't news. The Observer saying that Corbyn will table an immediate vote of no confidence in Theresa May's government as early as Tuesday evening, with Labour MPs, even those who are currently unwell, ordered to turn up. But according to The Observer, this is an irresponsible approach, because The Observer says there is no realistic route to a general election since May's DUP partners and Eurosceptic MPs will not vote to trigger this vote of no confidence. So The Observer has called on Labour to support another referendum, warning Corbyn that otherwise he risks even becoming entirely complicit in a Brexit tragedy. Jeremy Corbyn. Now, he was on the Mar show this morning, seeing as we're talking about Labour. What happens in the event that Theresa May loses this vote on Tuesday? Jeremy Corbyn, what happens?
If she loses that vote, as most people at the moment assume, they may be wrong, but if she does lose that vote, do you immediately put down a vote of no confidence in the government?
We will table a motion of no confidence in the government at a time of our choosing, but it's going to be soon, don't worry about that.
Barry Gardiner used the word immediately. That's why I'm getting overexcited, perhaps, but I'm assuming that you'll do it very quickly.
Andrew, don't get too excited about it. There's only 2 days to wait till the vote. I know it's your job, but it's 2 days to wait for the vote. We'll have the vote, and then you'll see what happens.
So you're not promising to put down a vote of confidence on Tuesday night or Wednesday morning?
You'll see what happens.
Yeah, one of the most patronising arseholes that's ever trodden the corridors of Westminster, Jeremy Corbyn. For me, utterly detestable. They're all detestable, but I have a special place in my heart for Corbyn. Anyway, supposing you win the next election, says Marr, will Labour have a manifesto that will deliver Brexit? So Marr is looking ahead. May has to resign. There's crisis in the Conservative Party. Somehow we end up in a general election. Labour wins it, either Labour wins it or Corbyn heads a coalition government. Will Labour have a manifesto that will deliver Brexit?
Look, our manifesto will reflect on the reasons why people voted the way they did in 2016. People were very angry in those areas that voted Leave. People were also very angry in those areas that voted Remain. They actually have the same interests, as I was pointing out in my Wakefield speech on Thursday. We cannot ignore the fact that a lot of people in this country are very angry about their feeling of being left behind, lack of investment, poor quality jobs, lack of support on housing,
but
health, and all this.
Brexit. It's also Brexit, isn't it?
Brexit is keyly a key part of that as well. There are those in the Remain areas that want to live, quite rightly so, as I do, in an open, inclusive society which has open relations with the rest of the world. Others just feel very angry, and they didn't feel that the EU was delivering for them.
Clear question, clear answer. In your manifesto, will you be promising to deliver Brexit?
We have a manifesto commitment of 2017 which respect the result of the referendum. We had a comprehensive conference motion last year which included a number of events, which were the first of which happens on Tuesday. Obviously, our process will decide exactly what goes in the manifesto as soon as we know an election's coming.
Ah, Jeremy.
You know you're a lying, low-life, motherfucking gambling degenerate prick. You know that's what you are?
That's what he is. Greatest flip-flopper in history. As I've said 1,000 times, never before was there a backbench politician so opposed to the tyranny of the European Union because of what it meant for manufacturing jobs in this country. But now he is a hair's breadth away from power. And Jeremy will say whatever he's told to say, just like the rest of them. So what about the unwashed then? That's you and me, by the way. Speak for yourself, Richie. I know, the unwashed, the plebs, the electorate. What do we think? Chris Curtis from YouGov, the pollsters, YouGov, major polling company. Chris Curtis was on Sky News this AM. What are we thinking? What are the public thinking?
And I think the most consistent message that we're getting in our research is that the public really don't like the deal that she's brought back.
Well, why?
Well, I wouldn't say that there's necessarily a specific element of the deal or a specific policy of the deal. I think it's a very long document, 500 or so pages, and it's unlikely the public will have read all of it. But what they're doing is they're reacting to the ways that political actors are behaving, the ways our politicians are behaving, the way the news is covering it generally. And when you have a Conservative Party that's divided on it and a Labour Party that's opposing it, you can see how a majority of the public have a negative view of
it. But on this issue, it's presumably quite important to know if there were 50% of people opposing it, for example.
But just under 50% opposing it, and just under a quarter of the public support it.
Okay, but you know, are they opposing it because they don't think it's Brexit enough, or are they opposing it because they don't want Brexit?
To be honest, it's a little bit of both. So this is the other problem that the Prime Minister faces, that she's fighting the battle on two fronts. So you have some people that are opposing the deal on one side because they'd prefer a deal, or Leave voters oppose the deal because many of them would prefer a deal that better respects the referendum result, and the vast majority of Remainers also oppose the deal because a lot of them would prefer that we stayed in the European Union after all. So that's part of the battle that she's facing, is there's no clear coalition that's coming behind this deal on the Remain or the Leave side.
Yeah, it shouldn't matter though. It shouldn't matter what the coalitions are, what the percentages are. The fact is people voted to leave 2.5 years ago and we're still there. No nearer leaving than we were 10 years ago. Is where we are. So what's the bottom line then with the public? Second referendum, is it?
We are starting to see momentum in favour of this idea of a second referendum. In our most recent polling, we asked, if Parliament rejects the deal, would you support a second referendum? 41% said they'd support that, 38% oppose. But even then, you can see that it could be bitterly divisive. So 55% of Leave voters say that if there was a second referendum and Remain won, they'd feel betrayed by that result.
Yeah. You think? Yeah, to say the least. I'll tell you what we'll do. We're going to leave Brexit with a giggle today. Labour backbencher John Mann. Do you know John Mann? Do you remember John Mann chasing after Ken Livingstone? John Mann, the massive friend of Israel, loves Israel, John Mann, runs two different anti-Semitism witch hunting groups. That's what he does for shits and giggles. What do you do in your spare time, John? I root out anti-Semitism. That's what I do. He's the witchfinder general, John Mann. He's one of the biggest arseholes that's ever lived. Right? John Mann is worried that no deal is going to make a balls of his favourite pastime. I heard this morning and I had to play it back two or three times because I thought I heard it wrong. I looked at my calendar to make sure that indeed it is January 13th and not April 1st. John Mann is worried that no deal is going to screw up his favourite pastime, which is, believe it or not, horse racing. Yeah. John Mann tells Sky News this morning that he's really worried that no deal will screw up horse racing. And it's all about Irish horses. John Mann.
And the other option is Anne-Marie Trevelyan's, a so-called no deal. That's a bit of a false option. There's no such thing as no deal. The no deal option actually means thousands of deals into the future with the European Union. I'll give you one example. I'd raised a small matter, the Grand National, on the 6th of April. With a no deal, unless we have a deal with the Irish, then no Irish horses will be coming to the Grand National. And if we don't have a permanent deal, either with Ireland and the Irish government or the European Union, then British horse racing collapses because there'll be no Irish horses ever here again.
There'll be no Irish horses ever here again. Can you believe it? John Mann appealing to the horse racing fraternity in the UK. We must stop no deal or we'll never have any Irish horses over here ever again. Jesus Christ. We'll never have any Irish horses. Do you know what? If you're short of Irish horses, just go to Appleby Fair. Is that what it's called? Appleby, where the travellers turn up with about 150,000 horses once a year. It's an amazing thing. It's almost like people going to the River Ganges to pray and to swim in it. The Appleby Horse Fair, where the travellers turn up. I think you can see it from space. There's no danger that horse racing is going to collapse without a deal. So that's taken the fear-mongering to all new levels. But it's also quite funny as well. There'll be a lot of English trainers, of course, who are sick to death of Irish horses hammering their horses and taking away all the big prizes from Cheltenham and Aintree every year. They'll be damn glad to see Irish horses banned from travelling to the United Kingdom. Tiny country is the country of my birth, but we breed the best horses in the world, don't we? I don't know how we do that, but we do. I don't know very much about it. I have a friend who knows more than I do, though. It is exactly 29 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. Yeah, yeah. I'm going to take a musical break, and then we're going to talk about Dr. David Kelly when we come back. Sunday View. Sunday View on richieallen.co.uk, Fab Radio 2, triggerwarning.tv, and TuneIn Radio. Sure. And Heart of Stone, what a song that is. 26 minutes, 25 minutes even to the top of the hour. Thanks for staying with me. Lots of tweets, I'll get through a few of them before we move on and talk about Dr. David Kelly. Dean Smith, Dean, good morning. Brexit ruins the Grand National. I've just weed a little bit, says Dean, with laughter. Yeah, John Mann. Patrick Vadine there with a video. Thanks for that, Patrick, about the Witchfinder General John Mann. Rich tweets, arseholes, all of them. Do I care if there's no Irish horses? Yeah, I don't because I've never had much interest in horse racing. But I have friends who keep horses and who are interested in horse racing. Hugely important for the economy, horse racing, by the way. Whether you're a fan of the sport or not, whether you're horrified by the jumps the horses are asked to complete during the Grand National, if you think it's cruel and all of that, and I wouldn't necessarily disagree with you, by the way, it generates an enormous amount of money for the economies of the UK and Ireland. There's no doubt about that. Good morning to Gail. Good morning to John Martin Sheehy. Good morning, John. Thanks for listening to the programme. Good morning to Sean McDonald, lady and Sean, who predicts Theresa May loses the vote. No confidence. Overthrown. She's gone. Public election. Labour takes on a second Brexit vote, a new referendum, and we stay in. Corbyn then goes the way of Theresa May. Move on. Next. That's actually quite plausible, that. May goes. There's an election. Corbyn wins. There's a second referendum. Corbyn leaves. Move on. Next. Hi to Chris Poacher. How you doing, Chris? Corbyn stating that the European Union is an open relationship, but we pay millions for the privilege of this freedom. Chris, you are right, my friend. And this is a point that would have been made repeatedly by Jeremy Corbyn during his time on the backbenches, all those decades of being on the backbenches. This is the thing, you see. These are the damned, tweets Richie. It shows how dumbed down people are in this country. They are still listening to this fool's derailing Brexit. And there has been no total non-compliance by the 17 million people that put their faith and trust in the political class to deliver Brexit. He's saying these are the damned. He's saying, Richie, where is the non-compliance by those who voted to leave? Yeah. Good morning to at wakeup60324665. Good morning. Richie, the only threat to democracy comes from the globalist shills in Parliament. We don't have a democracy, mate. You're absolutely right. Good morning to Susan. Good morning to Kim. Good morning to David, who says Plan B, complete capitulation into slavery. Think we're already there. Good morning to Ricky as well. Thanks for joining me this morning, friends. I genuinely appreciated it. Makes me happy. It warms my heart that you do that with me every Sunday morning. Right, we're going to move on and we're going to talk a little bit about Dr. David Kelly, because my friend and colleague Jeanne Crowley sent me an email overnight and she said there's a story in the Mail on Sunday today. It was also picked up by The Sun on Sunday, and it's a story about new evidence that suggests that Dr. David Kelly, the former weapons inspector, did not commit suicide back in 2003. Wasn't it 2003? I think it was. Long time ago. The headline in the Mail on Sunday is "Damning New Evidence That Dr. Kelly Didn't Commit Suicide. The Disturbing Flaws in the Official Government Story Surrounding the Death of Blair's Chemical Weapons Expert." I'll read you just a smidgen of this. The article is written by a man called Miles Goslett, who wrote a book about this, which came out in hardback last year. It's now available in paperback. His book is called An Inconvenient Death: How the Establishment Covered Up the David Kelly Affair. So it's his article in the Mail on Sunday. And he writes, more than 15 years have passed since Dr. Kelly was found dead in an Oxfordshire wood in one of the darkest episodes of Tony Blair's time as Prime Minister. The official explanation was that the distinguished weapons expert had taken his own life by overdosing on painkillers and cutting his left wrist. Devastated after being unmasked as the source of the BBC's claim that the government had sexed up the case for the Iraq war. But since Dr. Kelly's death in 2003, time has done nothing to dispel the cloud of suspicion that hangs over the episode. The troubling questions surrounding it have only increased as the years have passed. Successive governments have refused to allow a full coroner's inquest to be held, fueling the sense of a cover-up. Long-time listeners to the Richie Allen Show will know that I've been speaking to some of these doctors since back in 2008, 2009, during my time in Spain. He writes in the Mail on Sunday, he continues, does Miles Goslett, the author, he writes, "I've spent years examining the case, and like some surgeons, barristers, coroners and judges I know of, I cannot accept the official explanation that Dr. Kelly took his own life. He then goes on to talk about his book, published last year, which contains the evidence to support his claims. He says since the book was published, he has amassed even more compelling information from new, highly credible sources, which casts more serious doubt on the claims that Dr. Kelly cut his own wrists. And that's obviously very important that you keep that in mind, this notion that he cut his own wrists. By continuing my investigation, I have sometimes been dismissed as a conspiracy theorist, but I have no political axe to grind, and there is nothing fantastical about the facts of this case. Dr. Kelly's body was discovered on the 18th of July 2003, days after he had been grilled publicly in front of a select committee of MPs about his contact with BBC journalist Andrew Gilligan. Gilligan had reported that the government dossier, which claimed that Iraq could deploy weapons of mass destruction at 45 minutes notice, was unreliable, exaggerated, or sexed up for political purposes. And Dr. Kelly, a chemical weapons expert who worked for the Foreign Office and the Defence Ministry, was unmasked by Downing Street officials as the BBC's informant. So obviously, dear listener, if you know the story, and you might not know the story, this was an incredibly distressing thing for Dr. David Kelly. For the government to release, to leak his name into the public domain and say that Dr. David Kelly, who's a medical doctor, by the way, he's not a PhD, a medical doctor who worked as a weapons expert also, that Kelly was the source for the BBC story. The BBC story that said correctly that the dossier was sexed up. They used very benign language at the time. I could swear and rant and rave here now, but I won't do that. There's no need for it. Sexed up doesn't even cut what the government did. The government knew full well that the Saddam Hussein government, if you want to call it the Iraqi government, I'm sure they still call it a regime. They knew full well that Saddam had nothing. And the reason they knew that Saddam had nothing was because anything Saddam did have, he was given by the Americans, by the British, and by the Israelis. Yes, the bastard trinity of UK, Israel, and the United States, the unholy fucking trinity, had given everything that they had to Saddam Hussein to blow Iran off the map. And they knew that he had expended that arsenal. They knew he had nothing. So saying that it was sexed up, little walk down memory lane here, dear listener, is a joke. 'Twas a fucking lie. 'Twas a disgraceful lie. Because it was a lie that condemned millions of people to their deaths. Once that lie was allowed to grow and to thrive in public discourse, once people on the highways and byways of the UK were talking about it as a fact that this brutal dictator could launch against the United Kingdom in 45 minutes, the fate of millions of people in that region was decided. Like that, gone. Kelly knew it was bullshit. Not just Kelly. Hans Blix and many others knew it was bullshit. But the warmongering fucking madman Tony Blair was determined, no matter what, the UK would do what it was told and would go with the United States of America. Kelly was unmasked as the source for one reason and one reason only, dear listener, so that he could be murdered. Why? The damage was done then, Rich, you might say. Yes, the damage was not really done. People are sheep. Okay, more than a million people marched in London against the war. They weren't sheep, God loved them. But they went home. And we bombed Iraq back to the Stone Age anyway. So, Kelly was killed to silence him. Kelly wasn't killed to silence him. He had said all that he could say. Kelly was murdered to send a message out to other civil servants. Whatever aspect, whatever branch they worked in, if you do anything like he did, we'll kill you. That's what happened. Now, Dr. David Halpin is an amazing man. I've had him on this show many times over the years. But I couldn't dig out one of my earlier interviews with Dr. David Halpin. Dr. David Halpin is a renowned trauma surgeon. And he's a bit of a genius. Renowned trauma surgeon and paediatrician. Wonderful man. Beautiful man. In every sense of the word. Him and his wife, the things they've done for Palestine, for raising awareness about the conditions the people are living in Gaza. But he did so much at the outset to throw light on the lies and the deception and the evil around the death of Dr. David Kelly. So here's Dr. David Halpin speaking at a public meeting some years ago. And he talks about Lord Hutton, who chaired the inquiry. There should have been an inquest, of course, not an inquiry. And you'll hear him talk in a minute about how Dr. Kelly couldn't have killed himself in the manner we were told he did. But at the very beginning of this, you will hear Dr. Halpin describing Lord Hutton and describing how the inquiry itself was a farce because people were not interviewed under oath and so on. This is the wonderful Dr. David Halpin. Have a listen to this.
Halpin could not subpoena witnesses. He couldn't make them come.
I forgot to mention, he couldn't even subpoena witnesses. He couldn't insist that people come and give evidence because it wasn't an inquest, it was an inquiry.
There was no oath and no cross-examination. It was a superb example of British treachery and of the new Labour government in particular. The verdict of this elaborate sham, this whitewash, as it was called, was 1A hemorrhage, 1B incised wounds to the left wrist, and 2 coproximal ingestion and coronary artery atherosclerosis. I did not believe one could die of hemorrhage in this way. I understand that. A short letter was published in the Morning Star, 16th of December 2003. I'd hesitated because I didn't want to upset the Kelly family. The key part of my little letter was, as a past trauma and orthopedic surgeon, I cannot easily accept that even the deepest cut into one wrist would cause such exsanguination that death resulted. Exsanguination is loss of blood, or complete loss of blood, or near complete loss of blood. The two arteries are of mastic size. That happily, that little soundbite had stuck in the press and would have quickly shut down and clotted. Furthermore, we have a man who was expert in lethal substances and who apparently chose a most uncertain method of suicide. It is in fact preposterous that he chose to die that way. In fact, it was only one artery. Not the one you can feel easily, the ulnar artery. The vital importance, it's a very important point this, the vital importance of residual free press was shown by the fact that a fellow doctor, a public health consultant, had written with a Syrian colleague saying that their study of the national statistics had shown that death from slashing a wrist was so rare it was well nigh impossible. They wrote 3 months before to The Guardian, The Independent, and The Mail. This is our free press. All failed to publish it. They were marching in step with the totalitarian government.
Yeah, they were in step with a totalitarian government. He described there how a collaboration of very experienced doctors and academics wrote a letter expressing their incredulity at the findings, at the Hutton findings, at the suggestion that a doctor like Dr. David Kelly would attempt to kill himself in such a patently ridiculous way. That letter was sent to the national newspapers in this country, and none of them would publish it. So, in tandem, in step with a totalitarian government. These are the same fucking newspapers that admitted that they didn't do their job in holding the Labour government to court in the run-up to the Iraq war. They acknowledged it, all of them, in editorials in the late 2000s, if I remember. Acknowledged that they had let their readers down in not challenging more robustly the obvious lies of the Blair government about the reasons and the necessity to send British troops to Iraq, to a country that had never threatened the United Kingdom, had given no inclination at all that it was threatening the United Kingdom or any of the UK's allies. The papers acted as cheerleaders for that war. Cheerleaders. Bad enough that it was happening here, but the Irish media of the day, so-called neutral country. Of course, the Republic of Ireland, Ireland is not neutral. It can't be as a member of the European Union. It can pretend that it's neutral all at once. It isn't. And of course, Shannon Airport was used by US bombers to refuel on their way to blowing men, women and children to smithereens in Baghdad. But the Irish media was just as bad. The Irish paper of record, The Times, just as bad cheerleading this war. It had to happen. For the many reasons we talk about on this programme, had to happen. That war, because it's part of a bigger overall plan. Dr. David Kelly was murdered for speaking out and telling Andrew Gilligan that the dossier was basically bollocks. So it's interesting that it's in the mail on Sunday today. We'll try and get the author of the book on the programme. Mr. Goslett. Is it Goslett or is it Gossett? Goslett, isn't it? And we'll see, can we get him on and talk to him about it? I understand, it's Miles Goslett, yeah. I understand that former Labour MP, former Respect MP, George Galloway, has crowdfunded a film about the circumstances around the death of David Kelly. That'll be worth a look, I suppose, when it comes out as well. Sunday View with me, Richie Allen. 6 minutes to the top of the hour. I'm going to leave you with this. Talked a lot last week about the staging of right-wing protests. Now listen, I've no sympathy with conservatives. I have no sympathy with liberals. I have no sympathy with progressives. None. I'm apolitical. If anything, I voted on the left my entire life. I voted Sinn Féin. I voted the Socialist Workers' Party before I saw the light 15 or so years ago. Never voted for a conservative or a right-wing politician. I get asked this question all the time because I'm so hard on Corbyn. I'm hard on Corbyn because so many people have fallen for his bullshit. People who should know better. Anyway, this whole right-wing nonsense at Westminster screaming at Anna Soubry last week and Owen Jones and Faisal Islam was staged. It was staged to create the impression that people who want to leave are basically knuckle draggers who hate everybody who doesn't agree with them and who hate people of from ethnic minority backgrounds. Now on Thursday, Owen Jones of The Guardian was on a programme called This Week, which is presented by Andrew Neil, and he's helped out by Liz Kendall and Michael Portillo. And Jones was on there, and Michael Portillo had a go at Jones and basically accused Labour of being an anti-Semitic party. Said that Jeremy Corbyn was, you know, scaring Jews, the Jews were terrified of Jeremy Corbyn and all the rest of it, all that garbage, which of course is absolute garbage. And the accusations by Michael Portillo, the accusations of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, gave Owen Jones an open goal to begin virtue signalling. But it didn't end well for Owen Jones. I'm just loading it now. This is Owen Jones on This Week, taking the opportunity to virtue signal to the UK's Jewish population and then to talk about racism. Have a listen, Owen Jones.
You're right, anti-Semitism needs to be driven out the left. It is a disgusting disease wherever it manifests itself and has no place whatsoever within the left or anywhere, frankly, for that matter. But that point you just made, the immigrant scapegoating and demonising of conservative politicians led to the hostile environment. The hostile environment led to black Britons being denied healthcare, being kicked out of their homes, and dozens of them being deported from this country. That was a racist policy instituted by your party. I'm not taking lessons from that. And I have to say, on that, over the last few years, what we've seen is the scapegoating by mainstream politicians and much of the media of immigrants for all the crimes and injustices caused by the powerful, the lack of affordable housing, the lack of secure jobs, stagnating living standards, the public services that migrants depend on. The absolute cornerstone of far-right politics is to scapegoat minorities, demonise them for all the problems in society. And when we see now the revival, the rise of Tommy Robinson, which has captured UKIP and which is poised to benefit from a so-called Brexit betrayal sentiment in this country, and they are, you know, we're talking about
bring Liz in
viral online, and the strength of that is very, very frightening indeed.
Very frightening indeed. Jones is the greatest virtue signaller there's ever been. He's also one of the most detestable human beings that's ever worked in the UK media. But Michael Portillo has been around a bit longer than Owen Jones, and he has him for breakfast.
Owen himself is guilty of the thing about which he makes an accusation. In other words, he takes an incident outside the House of Commons. He takes, all right, the rise of some very nasty people. And he takes that, and then he tries to smear the entire Conservative Party with that. Now, this is the breakdown of decent discourse. It is absolutely outrageous what you say. And I think many people will be shocked, because the fears that people have had about immigration are indeed what lay behind, I dare say, why many people voted for Brexit. And one of the reasons they did that was that for years and years and years, when they expressed a fear about the pressure on jobs or schools or social services or the health service, someone like you would come along and say that these people were racist.
Yes!
And that they were anti-Muslim.
Absolutely!
And that they were trying to drive black people out. No. And that they were making a racist case. And people have heard...
I wish you could see Jones's face. You can watch the clip on YouTube. It's fantastic just looking at his face. He's thinking, as he's being addressed by Portillo, fuck, I've nowhere to go here. Yes! Poor people have for years been lamenting the influx of unskilled migrants, not just from ethnic minority backgrounds, but from parts of Europe, coming in, taking low-skilled or unskilled jobs away from the indigenous population, and it's not their fault, by the way, the migrants, not their fault, plunging people into poverty and putting pressure on public services. When people have expressed an opinion, dickheads like Jones have called them racist from his bully pulpit in The Guardian, and Michael Portillo is having him for breakfast with a little dose of salt and pepper. It's lovely, this.
I've heard you again this evening, and I think, oh my goodness, well look, I have some concerns about immigration, and here's this fellow trying to tell me that anybody who has that view is part of some right-wing conspiracy.
Not only have you learnt nothing, you are now trying to smear lots of decent people absolutely
from the Conservative Party upwards and downwards.
I grew up in a community which voted to leave the European Union. People I grew up with voted to leave the European Union. In no way am I doing that.
Now, yeah, he is doing it. What he does next is refuse to answer the question or address the points made to him by Michael Portillo. And what he does next is starts talking about the Windrush generation scandal again. He immediately starts talking about that and ignores what Portillo said to him. You, little men like you, little prole pretenders, champagne socialists, millionaires, telling people in poverty that they are racist when they say, I can't get a fucking job because there's a Polish guy in the factory across the street. That's what's going on. You're a racist. No, I'm not. I want a job, man. Why are the important people into the country, into my community, to take a job that I could have? It's brilliant by Portillo. Absolutely brilliant. Annihilation of Jones. And of course, this is why Owen Jones has for years refused to accept the invitation of people like me to come on programmes like mine. Because he hasn't a leg to stand on when it comes to discussing these issues rationally. Racism exists, yes. There are people who blame the dark-skinned man or woman for everything. Yes, of course. Of course. But the vast majority of people don't care whether you're black, white, fucking blue, yellow or pink. All they care about is if you're nice. People are too consumed by the struggles of getting from A to B, from getting to the end of the month. That's what's consuming people's thoughts, their fucking dreams, their realities. Not that they hate some guy over there because he wears a turban. Because he's a Sikh, they couldn't care less. 99 people out of 100. The rise of the far right is a myth. It's a mythology. Again, a media-driven mythology. It's very easy to film a few fucking idiots screaming at Anna Soubry and say, massive rise of the right. Portillo pointed out to Jones earlier in the segment, at the last election in this country, 84% of people who voted, voted for Labour or for the Tories. There is no evidence that the far right is on the rise. But those who seek to keep me and you fighting and hating one another instead of turning our collective glance or our collective gaze at them will foster this narrative, and they will use puppets like Owen Jones. Pro-pretender, look it up. Champagne socialist, look it up. Not a socialist bone in his body. I don't care what part of the country you were born in. I don't care how many members of your family voted Labour. You are no socialist. No real socialist would ever seek to close down an argument by calling somebody a racist. Genuine socialists were champions of free speech and an open discussion about ideas, no matter what those ideas were. No socialist. Not in a million years. Not in a million years. That was Sunday View. That woke you up at the end there. Thanks for listening to it. Going to close out with Duran Duran. Packed week of shows beginning tomorrow at 5. Bye now.